I took a boat ride once on the Sea of Galilee. Really, it is the Lake of Galilee, because it is not what our imaginations over the millennia have made it. It's just this lake, this beautiful lake, a place filled with citrus groves and farms, places where Jewish settlers have been living in communal villages since the earliest dreams of the nation of Israel. The Sea of Galilee is wedged in this little dip between the mountains of the Golan Heights and the desert that surrounds everything in that part of the world. Every town, every settlement, every dot on the map surrounding that lake is filled with history, with legend, and with sorrow. On that trip, we had been staying in a guest house on a kibbutz where largely secular Jewish people from all around Europe had been fishing the calm waters of the lake since sometime before 1948, when Syrian tanks came down from the Golan Heights above to burn it all, and so the villagers say they stopped those tanks with their own bodies. A human barricade against the flames and the guns and the fear. In the 1960s and beyond, snipers filled those mountains in the Golan Heights, and even today, one casts their eyes upward to the hills and wonders who might be waiting there, just out of sight. Meanwhile, across the West Bank, Palestinian cities are cut off from commerce, and their history and culture crumble beneath poverty, isolation, and encroachment. Posters of teenage boys holding great big guns adorn the Church of the Nativity, the traditional birthplace of Christ. Israeli teenagers go to the movies wearing AK-47s, and the ancient city of Jericho lies in tattered ruin underneath the date palms. It is even now an unsettling place to be. The problems of the people, of the world, of us all, seem close at hand in that beautiful place. As if the air itself pulses with both beauty and pain. The loveliness of it all is paired with a sense of dread and the pervading reality of overwhelming obstacles and a division to which none of us have the answer. One is tempted in that place to blot it all out and focus instead on something more innocuous, like the sunlight glinting off the water or the innumerable gift shops which dot every roadway and sometimes seem to be the one thing that transcends political and religious differences in this place. Everybody in Galilee, after all, is in the tourist business, as are most people in Bethlehem and Nazareth and Jericho. Muslim or Jew, Zionist or Islamist, there is always that. And on this boat ride in the middle of the sea upon which the great man is said to have walked, there were CDs of bad Christian music for sale and rosaries of olive wood tinkling in the breeze. One is tempted there not to think of the problems of this region and the world. One is tempted merely to sit on the boat and watch the waves and think of lovely things like miracles that happened a long, long time ago. And it was a beautiful day, and the sea was still enough. And perhaps I could have just been there in that moment, surrounded by religious commerce and pious remembrances. But as we trolled around that lake, something grabbed me and wouldn't let go. I mentioned earlier that the Sea of Galilee is in a sort of depression in the midst of mountains on one side and desert on another, and as we rounded a turn on the boat, I saw that there was a break in the mountains. It was like a great big lawnmower had gone through and cut a path through the rocks, scattering hills like weeds in its path. Our tour guide told us that single break in the mountains was the one path that led from Galilee to Jerusalem. Even now, when people drive to the city, it is through that pass that they must travel. There is only one way to get from here to there, and the crack in the mountain beckoned me more than any other holy sight in that sacred land. Right there was the way to Jerusalem. The valley right in front of us, cutting a swath between those ancient and war-torn peaks, was the only way from this quiet valley to that great city. And it was the way that Jesus would had to have gone all those years ago when he ended his ministry in the Galilee among his friends. And he took those first, most dangerous steps toward what would be the end of his life and the beginning of a different story. On that boat, with the tinkling sounds of olive wood rosaries and the cheesy pop Christian music, I was looking at the path he had to walk. The only route he could have traveled to get from here to there, from a place where he was safe to a place where everything he feared and everything he was called to do patiently waited for him. Everywhere in the Holy Land, as you might imagine, people speak of the fact that this is where Jesus walked. Even the water I was floating on was marked by his footsteps. But I was looking that day upon a path both literal and spiritual that was too holy for words, because it was a path that took the most courage to walk. A path that changed him from just a minor provincial preacher to the man who would alter history forever. Think about it. What it took to put one foot in front of another, to walk through that valley and onward to the waiting city. Imagine what it took to start that journey. I do not know everything, or even most things, about Jesus and his time, but I know at least three things. That this man had been preaching throughout the Galilee for 3 solid years about the corruption and injustice of the Roman Empire. That he was no dummy, and that the city of Jerusalem toward which he walked was the seat of Roman power in Judea. When he made his way through that mountain pass, not being a dummy, he was making his way toward a hornet's nest, and he knew it. To my mind, he probably even knew that the Roman imperial powers he had so long railed against would find a way to kill him once he got there. And he walked anyway. He put one foot in front of the other, and he let that path take him where it led. Now, you all know I am not one for preaching that Jesus' death on the cross did all this fabulous stuff like save us from our brokenness and turn him into God. I'm pretty sure it was just a death, and an ignominious and hateful and saddening one at that. But I do believe that the courage of that man to stand up against an empire changed the world. I do believe that those first footsteps from the safe shores of that lake to the waiting city were the beginning of something great, and I do believe it took courage to take those steps in the face of forces that mighty and stakes that impossible. We might have the courage to take our own steps too, toward our own new beginnings, away from our safe harbors, among our friends, and toward our own great callings, even if frightening things await there. And our great callings don't have to entail the overthrowing of an empire, though who knows, yours might. Those callings don't have to be the stuff of legend and history books, but beyond the mountains of most of our lives, beyond the safety of our comfort zones and our verdant valleys, lies something of which we are afraid and to which we are nonetheless drawn, a calling of our own and a road upon which we must be brave enough to walk. In our reading this morning, Carrie Egan, herself a pilgrim who walked a holy journey, says that the act of walking is at the heart of it, fallen. You pick one foot up off the floor, and then you shift the bulk of your weight, the center of your gravity, to that foot before it ever hits the ground. You could not possibly stay in the mid-step position. You can't hold it. The law of gravity says you have to fall once you start moving forward. Once you have the courage to begin your journey, nothing can hold it back. Once you initiate that first step from here to there, spiritually or physically, there's no reeling it in. You've begun, and something new, something different other than the status quo is bound to happen one way or another. As such, the first step of a journey requires an enormous amount of courage, and I think a healthy dose of faith. It means giving up the safe harbors of complacency, of denial, even of home, in favor of the uncertain but holy territory of risk, of change, of power. How often we would rather just stand than walk, just stay than move, just cease from our explorations in favor of this known quantity or that one, this good enough reality or loving enough world. How many of us are content for now that there are enough people who are fed and enough souls who are comforted and enough injustice confronted? Such safety and such contentedness doesn't require us to strike out anew. It doesn't make us go through that mountain pass and face down the possibilities of a different future. And yet for each of us, at different times and in different measures, what we are and what we see are not enough. For some of us, at times, our calling lies not with the status quo or the safety of the present, but with the unknown wilds of a different choice that lies on the other side of a new beginning. It is quite something to stand at the beginning, before the first footstep. All the power in the world is contained in that moment, its pure potential, and anything at all is possible. But it is in the middle of the journey, once the path has been begun, that grace lives and transformation. Once the journey has begun, you can't go back home again. Holiness might even creep in, and renewed life might surprise us where we least expect it. Are you ready to walk? That's what the youth choir asked us today. Are you ready to walk? And are you? Ready to move from some safe harbor to some unknown place? Are you ready to leave behind something too familiar and venture forth even if you are afraid? I ask myself some version of that question all the time. Am I ready to give up an old pattern, an old behavior, a way of thinking of myself or a story I've told about my life so many times it doesn't have meaning anymore, in favor of a new story whose ending hasn't been written yet? Are you ready to walk away from a path that's going nowhere to a path that's going somewhere, even if you don't know where? Are you ready to walk to your own Jerusalem, to the place where everything that oppresses you and causes you pain waits patiently for your arrival so that you can face it down and come out the other side transformed? It takes one footstep to begin it. And that one footstep, that controlled fall, leads the way for all the others. I began this sermon quite intentionally reflecting on a problem almost unimaginably large and complex. In this case, the struggles in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine, this violent conflict that has plagued this nation or this world for the entire living memory of most people. It's a struggle that hangs in the air in Galilee where Jesus walked, the land that he left to go confront an empire. And that kind of struggle so big there are no easy answers. That kind of problem that feels as if it has no solution is exactly the sort of problem we are called to face down in our own lives every day. In most things that matter, there are no easy solutions. There are no magic cures. There is only a journey. A series of small footsteps strung together in a line, pointing somewhere new. The task then is not to solve it all. It's not to heal the whole world, or even heal the whole of our broken selves. We only have to take a step, a first step, and walk on bit by bit for as far as the path will take us. Are you ready to walk? No matter where your calling is, are you ready to take one step toward it and let that foot fall down in faith that it might be the beginning of a journey that can change it?